In the chilly January of 1963, two middle-aged Englishmen sat in a Beirut apartment, sipping tea and exchanging polite lies. Kim Philby and Nicholas Elliott, friends for nearly 30 years, were now bitter enemies locked in a deadly game of espionage. Their conversation, captured by a hidden microphone, marked the culmination of one of history's most extraordinary betrayals. Ben McIntyre's A Spy Among Friends has captivated readers worldwide since its publication, becoming an international bestseller translated into over 20 languages. The book inspired a critically acclaimed limited series starring Guy Pearce and Damian Lewis, with celebrities from Daniel Craig to John le Carré himself praising its meticulous research and gripping narrative. What makes this story so compelling is not just the scale of Philby's treachery, but how it exposes the vulnerability of human trust, showing how Britain's intelligence establishment was undone not by sophisticated tradecraft, but by the simple, devastating power of friendship. Kim Philby possessed a legendary charm, that intoxicating, beguiling, and occasionally lethal English quality that inspired unwavering loyalty. With his exceptional manners, gentle blue eyes, unruly forelock, and endearing stutter, he could make anyone feel they were the most important person in the room. His wartime credentials were impeccable. He survived a shell attack as a war correspondent in Spain, received decoration from Franco himself, and wrote distinctive dispatches for the Times during the early days of World War II. Philby's entry into MI6 followed the classic informal route of Britain's upper class, dropping hints among influential acquaintances. After a chance conversation with journalist Hester Marsden Smedley on a train, he was summoned by MI6's black propaganda section. His vetting process relied primarily on Valentine Vivian's declaration that I knew his people, a perfect example of the establishment's trust in bloodlines over background checks. Nicholas Elliott couldn't recall exactly where he first met Philby, perhaps MI6's secret bar, White's Club, or through Philby's future wife, Aileen. Their meeting was inevitable, as they were remarkably similar, both sons of imposing fathers who had attended Trinity College, both raised in the Empire's shadow, both products of elite schools. They formed an immediate bond, united by their secret work and shared worldview. Through Philby, Elliott joined a fraternity of clever, hard-drinking young Turks of British intelligence who gathered at Thomas Harris's Chelsea home. This salon included Guy Burgess, Anthony Blunt, and other intelligence officers who shared sumptuous meals and fine wines while discussing secret matters openly. Elliott found in this closed community people he could trust utterly, calling it a sort of convivial camaraderie. His bond with Philby grew deeper than mere friendship. Elliott hero-worshipped Philby with a powerful male adoration that was unrequited, unsexual, and unstated. What none of them knew was that beneath Philby's perfect English gentleman exterior lay a committed Soviet agent who had been recruited years earlier while at Cambridge. His charm wasn't just a personality trait, it was his most effective weapon. Kim Philby's journey to betrayal began at Cambridge, where he was swept up in the radical political currents of the 1930s. After witnessing Nazi brutality in Berlin, he gradually moved leftward politically. Before graduating, he sought guidance from his Marxist supervisor on how to devote his life to the communist cause, which led him to Vienna, where he met and married Litzi Kollmann, a committed Jewish communist activist. The pivotal moment came when Philby met Otto, Arnold Deutsch, in Regent's Park, a Soviet intelligence recruiter who captivated him immediately. Deutsch outlined a vision where Philby would abandon outward communist connections and instead pose as a right-winger, even a Nazi sympathizer, to infiltrate the British establishment. Philby embraced this double life enthusiastically, receiving tradecraft training and the codename Sonny. Following his handler's instructions, Philby joined publications, including the Nazi-funded Anglo-German Trade Gazette, cultivating a fascist persona as perfect political camouflage while secretly reporting to Moscow. He separated amicably from Lizzie and recruited Donald MacLean and Guy Burgess into Soviet service. Sent to Spain as a journalist covering Franco's forces, Philby impressed both the Times and Moscow with his reporting while gathering military intelligence. By 1939, Stalin's purges had eliminated all Philby's handlers, yet he remained ideologically committed despite briefly questioning the Nazi-Soviet pact. Following instructions to infiltrate British intelligence, Philby presented one face to Elliot, the charming clubman, while concealing his veteran communist spy identity. Working within MI6, Philby skillfully manipulated the organization's leadership, particularly C. Stuart Menzies, an old Etonian who rode to hounds and never missed Ascot. While Nicholas Elliot revered Menzies for his true sense of values, Philby privately considered him a prime specimen of the doomed ruling class elite with unimpressive intellectual equipment. What made Philby's deception so effective was that he never discussed politics or tested his convictions with others. After his early conversations with Arnold Deutsch, communism was rarely mentioned, even with his handlers. He maintained his certainties in perfect isolation, allowing him to present whatever face was needed to whomever he encountered. When Nicholas Elliot stumbled into espionage in June 1939, he could never have imagined the web of deception he was entering. After witnessing Hitler's military parade in Berlin, Elliot resolved to become a spy to help stop the Nazi threat. His early intelligence career in The Hague ended with the disastrous Venlo incident, where German agents captured two British officers. Despite this catastrophe, Elliot remained fascinated by espionage. Back in London during the Blitz, Elliot worked at MI5's wartime headquarters in Wormwood Scrubs Prison, serving as liaison between MI5 and MI6 while helping develop the double-cross system of turned German agents. He loved his new life, working in prison by day and enjoying freedom at night in a city under siege. His war experience turned tragic when his close friend Basil Fischer, a Hurricane pilot, was killed during the Battle of Britain. Shortly after this personal tragedy, Elliot met Philby, who would fill the emotional void left by Fisher's death. Meanwhile, Philby had been assigned to Section V of MI6, the counterintelligence division responsible for collecting information on enemy intelligence abroad. Working from War Station XB, a Victorian house in St. Albans, Philby became the group's animating spirit, described by Graham Greene as always relaxed, completely unflappable, and inspiring unwavering loyalty. The war years provided Philby with unprecedented opportunities for espionage. While appearing to serve British interests, he meticulously copied files each evening for Moscow. When Section V moved to Ryder Street in early 1943, Philby found himself perfectly positioned to assess and manipulate America's fledgling intelligence service, the Office of Strategic Services. As a respected veteran, Philby became an instructor for the Americans, briefing them on MI6's counter-espionage operations and British intelligence structure. Among these eager Americans, one stood out, James Jesus Angleton, a tall, cadaverous young man who studied espionage with obsessive dedication. Assigned to X2, the OSS counterintelligence section, Angleton impressed colleagues with his intensity, moving a cot into his office and studying counter-espionage secrets night after night as if they contained the secret of the Trinity. The two developed a mentor-protege relationship, with Angleton later acknowledging, "Once I met Philby, the world of intelligence that had once interested me consumed me. Kim taught me a great deal." This relationship would have devastating consequences for American intelligence for decades to come. In spring 1943, Nicholas Elliot orchestrated a devastating blow against German intelligence in Turkey. He persuaded Erich Vermehren, a young German anti-Nazi working for the Abwehr in Istanbul, to defect along with his wife Elizabeth. The Vermehrens provided detailed information about the Catholic underground resistance in Germany, potential leaders for a post-war anti-communist government. While MI6 deliberately withheld this information from Moscow, Philby secretly passed the list to his Soviet handlers. After the war, Allied officers discovered all these potential leaders had been deported or liquidated by Soviet forces advancing into Germany. Years later, Philby would acknowledge, "I was responsible for the deaths of a considerable number of Germans." An even more chilling betrayal came in late August 1944, when Konstantin Volkov, a Soviet intelligence officer in Istanbul, approached the British consulate offering to defect with explosive information about Soviet spies in Britain, including a Soviet spy heading a counterintelligence section in London. Philby immediately recognized this meant himself. That evening, he secretly contacted his Soviet handler, triggering a flurry of coded messages between London, Moscow, and Istanbul. The next day, Philby volunteered to handle the case personally, preventing other capable officers from taking charge. Deliberately delaying his departure, Philby arrived in Istanbul 22 days after Volkov's approach. By then, Soviet diplomatic couriers had already arrived. Two bandaged figures, Volkov and his wife, were loaded onto a Soviet aircraft, heavily sedated. In Moscow, they were tortured and executed. Philby's most devastating betrayals came during the early Cold War. As head of Section 9, specifically established to handle communists or people concerned in Soviet espionage, Philby informed Moscow of both British counter-espionage and espionage efforts against the Soviets. When Albanian guerrillas were infiltrated behind the Iron Curtain as part of Operation Valuable, Philby provided Moscow with vital information about the number of men involved, the day and time of landing, weapons, and program of action. The results were catastrophic. The first parachutists dropped in late 1950 were met by security forces who had advanced knowledge of their arrival. Some were killed immediately, others captured, with only a few escaping. For each guerrilla caught, as many as 40 relatives and associates were imprisoned or executed. The death toll reached hundreds, potentially thousands, including reprisal victims. Philby later claimed no remorse, as these were armed men intent on murder. But the cold calculation with which he sent men to their deaths while maintaining warm friendships with their handlers reveals the true depth of his compartmentalization. Days after arriving in Washington in 1949, Philby was appointed joint commander of the Anglo-American Special Policy Committee, responsible for running covert operations behind the Iron Curtain. While the Americans would increasingly finance these operations, Philby was the one who made all the operational decisions. Washington embraced Philby, and he thrived in its welcoming atmosphere. The family moved into a large house on Nebraska Avenue that soon became a gathering place for intelligence elites, with Eileen playing hostess at parties that were long and very, very wet. Philby cultivated relationships across American intelligence, making himself indispensable while privately disparaging many of his new colleagues. Philby's most valuable Washington relationship was with James Angleton, now Chief of Staff A in the CIA. The two men established a ritual of lunching at Harvey's Restaurant, an exclusive establishment on Connecticut Avenue frequented by the powerful. Their meetings began with bourbon, proceeded through lobster and wine, and ended with brandy and cigars. "Our close association was, I am sure, inspired by genuine friendliness," wrote Philby, "but we both had ulterior motives. Each believed he was manipulating the other. Angleton thinking he could drink Philby under the table and still walk away with useful information, while Philby knew exactly what he was doing." The relationship proved disastrous for American intelligence. Frank Wisner, the CIA officer in charge of insurgent operations behind the Iron Curtain, was baffled by the consistent failure of anti-communist operations. "We'll get it right next time," he promised Philby, but they never did. Operations in Poland funneled resources to what turned out to be a Soviet intelligence front. Anti-communist agents from various countries were recruited and infiltrated into Soviet territory, only to disappear. "We had agents parachuting in, floating in, walking in, boating in," recalled one CIA officer. "Virtually all these operations were complete failures." Years later, intelligence officials concluded that Angleton had unwittingly gave Philby over drinks the precise coordinates for every drop zone of the CIA in Albania. The friendship between these two master spies had deadly consequences, with Angleton's trust in his mentor resulting in the deaths of countless agents. The first crack in Philby's perfect cover came in May 1951, when fellow Soviet agents Guy Burgess and Donald McLean fled to Moscow. McLean had been identified as a Soviet agent codenamed Homer through the Venona Project, decrypted Soviet messages that revealed extensive espionage networks. Philby had warned McLean through Burgess, but was shocked when Burgess defected alongside him, despite promising to stay behind. Summoned to London in June 1951, Philby faced mounting pressure as CIA chief Walter Bedell Smith sent an aggressive letter to MI6 declaring Philby unwelcome in Washington. MI6 immediately rallied behind Philby, sending a message to MI5 declaring their wholehearted commitment to the protection of their protégé. Nicholas Elliott returned from Switzerland and leaped to his friend's defense with absolute conviction, finding it inconceivable that Philby could be a Soviet spy. Despite Elliott's passionate defense, Philby was forced to resign from MI6, though with a generous payoff that signaled continued support. After several interrogations, including an aggressive session with Buster Milmo and gentler questioning from William Jim Scarden, the case remained in limbo. MI5 was convinced of his guilt but lacked proof, while MI6 defended their man but couldn't fully exonerate him. By 1955, a faction within MI6, known as the Robber Barons, including Nicholas Elliott, launched a campaign to clear Philby's name. As public pressure mounted following newspaper revelations about the Petrov defection, which had implicated a third man in the Burgess-McLean affair, Philby underwent a fourth formal interrogation that MI5 officers later described as a travesty, a gentle conversation with former colleagues who guided him to acceptable answers. The climax came when Philby was questioned at a press conference in his mother's flat. He delivered a masterful performance of deception, claiming, "The last time I spoke to a communist, knowing him to be a communist, was sometime in 1934. Asked about his feelings toward Burgess, Philby paused dramatically before responding, "I consider his action deplorable. On the subject of friendship, I'd prefer to say as little as possible because it's very complicated." Soviet intelligence officer Yuri Modine marveled at Philby's breathtaking performance, concluding the British government had no serious evidence against him. Elliott was overjoyed at Philby's victory and the prospect of bringing him back into MI6, which raised Philby's hopes for further service to the Soviet cause. After the disastrous Buster Crab affair in 1956, when a British frogman disappeared during an unauthorized mission to investigate Soviet warships in Portsmouth Harbor, Nicholas Elliott arranged for Philby's return to MI6 as promised. Philby secured a position as a freelance correspondent in Beirut for The Observer and Economist while simultaneously working as an intelligence agent. Beirut proved ideal territory for both journalism and espionage, exotic, tense, and dangerous, with complex politics and no censorship. Philby cultivated sources useful for both professions while living first in his father's rented house and later in a flat in the Muslim quarter. There he met Eleanor Brewer, the restless, unhappily married wife of New York Times correspondent Sam Brewer. Their affair began after Eleanor invited the lonely Philby to join her party at the St. George's Hotel. In December 1957, Philby's wife Eileen died at 47, officially from heart failure and other health complications, though friends suspected suicide. 7 months later, when Eleanor finalized her divorce, Philby immediately informed her ex-husband Sam, who responded with remarkable sang-froid. That sounds like the best possible solution. Philby's behavior grew increasingly outrageous in Beirut, reminiscent of Guy Burgess's antics. Elliott not only tolerated but encouraged these provocations, delighting in recounting a particularly spectacular episode at a cocktail party where Philby loudly remarked to the British ambassador about a staff member's wife having the finest breasts in Beirut. The beginning of the end came in 1961, when George Blake, another Soviet mole in British intelligence, was exposed. Blake's capture suggested MI6 had new sources within Soviet intelligence. Having spied longer than Blake, at a higher level, and with greater human cost, Philby faced an even harsher fate if caught. The final blow came in August 1962, when Flora Solomon, a Russian-born British Jew who had created the welfare department at Marks & Spencer, revealed to Victor Rothschild that Philby had tried to recruit her as a spy in 1935. This provided the first direct evidence linking Philby to Soviet espionage. MI5 and Dick White debated how to handle Philby. A trial risked political embarrassment and might fail without a confession. They settled on sending someone to Beirut to confront Philby with the evidence and offer immunity in exchange for a full confession. Nicholas Elliott, who had just been promoted to MI6 Director for Africa, demanded to confront Philby himself, and Dick White agreed, believing Elliott's righteous anger might extract a confession. When Philby opened the door to find Nicholas Elliott waiting for him in Beirut on January 12, 1963, he simply remarked, "I rather thought it would be you." The confrontation that followed was a masterclass in English understatement, as Elliott pressed Philby about his treachery while maintaining the veneer of civility. "The game's up. We know what you did. We've penetrated the KGB," Elliott declared. When Philby protested his innocence, Elliott exploded. "You took me in for years. Now I'll get the truth out of you, even if I have to drag it out." Elliott then offered immunity in exchange for a full confession, or threatened to make Philby's life intolerable by withdrawing his passport and support. The next day, Philby returned with a 2-page typed confession, admitting recruitment by Soviet intelligence in 1934 through his first wife Litzy, untrue, and recruiting McLean and Burgess, true. He claimed to have stopped spying after the war, having seen the error of his ways. Elliott recognized this as a limited confession, but knew it transformed the situation. Philby had finally admitted guilt, however partially. After 4 days of confrontation, Elliott prepared to leave Beirut, telling Philby that Peter Lunn would continue the debriefing process. Back in London, Dick White was jubilant, convinced Philby would cooperate. Elliott's decision to leave Philby unguarded in Beirut was later condemned as a critical mistake. Remarkably, he left without arranging any surveillance. Philby wasn't followed, his phone wasn't tapped, and Lebanese security services weren't alerted. Days later, Philby met his KGB handler at an Armenian restaurant, explaining that MI6 had damning information. Moscow Center ordered his immediate extraction. On January 23, 1963, Philby left home claiming he would meet Eleanor at a dinner party. He was seen drinking at the St. George's Hotel before disappearing. Meanwhile, he was being driven to the harbor by Soviet agents, where he boarded the freighter Dolmatova bound for Odessa. Many intelligence insiders suspected Philby's escape wasn't the daring getaway portrayed in propaganda, but rather an engineered exit. "Philby was allowed to escape," wrote Desmond Bristow, while Soviet handler Yuri Modin believed the whole business was politically engineered, since a trial would have shaken the British establishment to its foundations. The evidence suggests Elliott and possibly Dick White deliberately left the door open, making it child's play for Philby to flee rather than face prosecution. Kim Philby found no true home in Moscow after his defection. Though welcomed as an agent, he was never fully trusted by the KGB, who suspected he might still be working for Britain. He remained quintessentially English, ironing old copies of the Times, drinking whiskey, eating marmalade, and lamenting modern cricket's innovations. His marriage to Eleanor collapsed when she discovered his affair with Melinda McLean, Donald's wife, continuing his pattern of betrayal. James Jesus Angleton, devastated by Philby's betrayal, descended into paranoia, convinced the CIA was riddled with Soviet spies. His obsessive mole hunting eventually destroyed his career and damaged the agency immeasurably. Nicholas Elliot watched his old friend Angleton's decline with sadness, believing he had been devoured by distrust and deceived by his own ingenuity. Elliot's career was hobbled by his association with the traitor. In his retirement, he became an eccentric figure, dowsing for buried treasure, practicing transcendental meditation, and serving as an unofficial intelligence advisor to Margaret Thatcher. Unlike Angleton, Elliot eventually found peace regarding Philby's betrayal, seeing it not as personal shame, but as the exploitation of his loyalty. Philby, after initial unhappiness in Moscow, found some contentment in his fourth marriage to Rufina Ivanovna, though he never expressed remorse for his actions. He died in 1988 with full Soviet honors, while Elliot kept his old umbrella as a memento of their complex friendship until his own death in 1994. The story of Philby, Elliot, and Angleton reveals how friendship can be both our greatest comfort and our most dangerous vulnerability. As Philby himself admitted, "I have always operated on two levels, a personal level and a political one. When the two have come into conflict, I have had to put politics first." In the shadowy world of espionage, where nothing is as it seems, perhaps the most dangerous deception is the one we practice on ourselves, believing we truly know another human being.